Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is supported by listeners, and today I'd like to single out John Zweibel of Hawaii, an extremely generous contributor who's helping underwrite the costs of this new podcast series of programs. You can help, too. The information's on my website at peterbcollins.com, and you can sign up for a monthly PayPal subscription. It's voluntary for as little as $5 a month. And I appreciate everybody who supports this effort. We're originating this program just about 12 hours after President Obama gave his speech at West Point announcing the escalation of the war in Afghanistan and the addition of 30,000 more American troops. And while he says that some of them will start to come home in 18 months, there are asterisks attached to that. In a moment, we'll be joined by journalists Reese Ehrlich and Robert Perry. Later in the program, we'll talk with Michael Blecker at Swords to Plowshares, a veterans aid agency in San Francisco, about the human cost, the projections of this escalation. And we'll wrap up the show today with Gary Chu's review of the new film called The Road. Reese Ehrlich is an independent journalist whose recent books include Dateline Havana, The Iran Agenda, and Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. He traveled to Afghanistan with our friend Norman Solomon and was on a previous podcast here about 6 weeks ago talking about that trip. Also with us is Robert Perry, a longtime contributor to our program and the editor-in-chief at ConsortiumNews.com. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, indeed.
Well, there's a lot to talk about here, and I'd like to offer some initial comments myself. We have some clips from the president's speech that I'd like to play and get your reaction to. My own view is that President Obama fell into the Bush zone and presented false choices, fear-mongering, talked about the advancement of peace and freedom through war. He conflated al-Qaeda and the Taliban, oversimplified the conflict in the region. And while he did correctly identify Pakistan as a true threat, he didn't explain how adding troops in Afghanistan really addresses that. He explicitly said that what he's proposing is not nation building, and frankly, I find that to be untrue. And as my colleague Stephen Pizzo has pointed out, his articulated three-point plan to defend the cities and essentially abandon rural areas is the same formula that the government of Pakistan has used that has left them vulnerable to Taliban and other insurgents who are serious challenges to the stability of that government. And fundamentally, I think the president misreads the situation by presenting the idea that massive military might using airstrikes and more American troops can actually take on this indigenous insurgency. And so those are the doubts that were raised for me in the president's comments last night. Reese, let me go to you first. What was your reaction, and what are some of the key points that you drew from the way he tried to sell this escalation?
Well, I think I agree with you that the President Obama has now echoed the worst of the arguments and positions of the Bush administration on this topic. And it's worse than what he did during the campaign. Some people argue this. Well, he said he was going to do that, but escalating to 100,000 troops, which is what the total is going to be, is a horrific decision. And it's self-contradictory. That is, on the one hand, we supposedly face this horrible, implacable terrorist enemy. If they came, the Taliban wins in Afghanistan or the U.S. pulls its troops out, then we're going to have the 9/11 terrorists back in power, basically. And yet, in somehow in 18 months, we're going to resolve the issue so we can start bringing our troops home. It's a, you know, if it's such a horrible threat, it's going to last longer than the 18 months.
Yeah.
What it really was a political cover, because the opinion polls have now decisively turned against the Afghan war. The majority of Americans do not support the president, do not support the war. So by claiming that there'll be some kind of a drawdown in 18 months, which, by the way, is incredibly vague, there was absolutely no specifics at all.
Yes.
It's designed to get people to accept the war for at least the next 18 months. And then when it fails after 18 months, we can blame somebody else and escalate it further or, I'm sorry, do whatever. So I think it's a disaster. It's going to be a stain as bad on the Obama record as the decision to escalate in Vietnam was on Johnson's record.
Yeah. And Bob Perry, you published a piece on November 30th called How the War Hawks Caged Obama. Give me your thoughts about how the president proved your points.
Well, it seems that he was making an inside-the-beltway political calculation, that it was easier in terms of dealing with the powers that be in Washington to go this route, even if it went against what the American people want, even when it basically was a repudiation of his base that favors a more peaceful approach to this problem. But if you look at it from a Washington perspective, that you want to keep, you don't want to be savaged by the Washington Post editorial page. You want to keep someone like Joe Lieberman on board for other purposes, including health reform. You don't want to have Bob Gates and Hillary Clinton, who were two of the principal hawks on this, who were pushing the 30,000 figure in these internal discussions. If you don't want them to sort of turn on you and start leaking negative information, the choice he made a certain amount of sense. That it may not be the easy solution for the soldiers and not for the country, and in a way not even for himself in terms of the broader public. But if you look at it from just how the Washington power centers function, this is something to keep the neocons from going totally berserk. And they're still extremely influential in Washington. They dominate the Washington Post editorial pages. They are very strong in the New York Times editorial pages. So you have this desire to appease those power centers. And frankly, he may be looking and seeing that on the left in America, there's very little that can cause him that kind of internal political damage. So I saw it as kind of a political equation that he was drawing up, where he felt this was the best way to move ahead without damaging himself too badly inside the Beltway.
Yeah. Well, and he did go out of his way to respond to the charge that he had been dithering by saying that his review didn't have any impact because these troops are going in quickly and the plan was to do it in 2010 anyway. And I thought that was a remarkably defensive statement for him to make in this context. Reese?
Absolutely. I think in addition to the forces that he was appeasing that Bob mentioned, you can't leave out the Pentagon, which is, remember, this whole escalation campaign began earlier this year when they sent 20,000 troops. That was supposed to solve the problem. When that didn't solve it, now then the Pentagon advocates of additional troops leaked information to key media to try and build up popular support for sending what they, at one point, they had said as many as 40,000 or 50,000 more troops. So I think Obama is somehow, by sending only 30,000, that's like a compromise or something like that. But it is an unmitigated disaster. You can't win this war militarily. The only thing that's going to result is more deaths of American soldiers and more civilian deaths in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. The president opened his speech by reciting details about 9/11, and it was interesting that he reiterated the authorization that was jammed through in the days right after 9/11 that got 98-0 support in the Senate and only a single opposing vote from the courageous Congresswoman Barbara Lee of Oakland in the House. And I think he used that to try to argue for the legitimacy of our continuing presence in Afghanistan. And he also tried to invoke, he didn't use the word coalition, but he tries to frame this as an international effort, which is a joke. We are bearing the brunt of this. And while there have been other nations, Germany, Britain, and Canada, that have put some troops in, their efforts have been very narrow. Most of them have been confined to bases. And they're there really just for photo ops. And so this is truly an American effort. And the president tried to dress it up. He tried to put lipstick on a pig, as we heard in the campaign last year.
Let's not forget there's a long history of this. The Vietnam War was a coalition effort. According to President Johnson, we had Australian and Filipino and South Korean troops in Vietnam. Iraq, let's not forget the Coalition of the Willing.
Yeah.
You know, 40-odd countries. I don't think they ever figured out the exact number because they kept falling off the list and not agreeing and pulling their troops out and whatever. That was a coalition effort. The key thing is it really a coalition? If the U.S. pulled out, what would the other countries do? They'd be gone the next day.
Yeah.
It's no coalition.
Now, here's a remarkable clip from the president's speech last night where he essentially tells us that we've been successful in Iraq.
Thanks to their courage, grit, and perseverance, we have given Iraqis a chance to shape their future, and we are successfully leaving Iraq to its people. But while we've achieved hard-earned milestones in Iraq, the situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated.
Now, this is remarkable, because the only real scoreboard I guess he's trying to get us to look at is that only two American troops died in Iraq in November. But we have not pulled any significant numbers of troops out, and he used a little sleight of hand just following this clip you just heard, where he said, well, you know, when I took office, there were 32,000 troops in Afghanistan, and at its peak, there were 160,000 troops in Iraq, as if the current number there makes it appear that he has drawn down our forces there. And he says still that combat troops, an undefined term, will come out by next summer, and that all American troops will be out of Iraq by the end of 2010. And he's trying to use the Iraqi surge and this vague plan for our withdrawal and a handoff to the turbulent Iraqi government as if that is an appropriate model for Afghanistan. Now, Reese, you were just there during the fraudulent election. And can you tell us that there is any hope for an 18-month effort to stabilize the government, build up their military, and permit us to withdraw under the kind of rosy scenario he described?
Well, in the spirit of Christmas, all I can say is ho, ho, ho. What a strange perception that one is. First of all, Iraq and Afghanistan are different. But going back to Iraq for just a second, hey, the surge didn't work in Iraq, folks.
Nope.
All it did was reduce violence for a period of time. The political issues underlying the violence have not been resolved. Iraq can't even hold its own parliamentary elections because the divisions are so great. The Kurds are ready to split off and form their own nation at any moment. The government in power is more favorable to Iran than it is to the United States on a lot of issues. The U.S. is facing an abysmal disaster in Iraq.
Reese, stop. That sounds like success to me.
Yes, we've sacrificed how many Americans and Iraqi lives so that we can have a pro-Iranian government in Iraq. Sounds good to me. Anyway, and Afghanistan is worse. Afghanistan is a very much poorer country. The soldiers, the U.S. trainers, complain that the Afghan soldiers and police can't read and write. They can't administer the logistics. They're more interested in providing ghost soldiers for corruption purposes. Afghanistan is the second most corrupt country in the world. It's aided and abetted by corruption on part of both the U.S. military and civilian aid programs, which I've written about. And you can't win a war when your allies are corrupt dictators.
Yep.
And that's the premise of the 18. Somehow, in 18 months, the Afghans will have taken responsibility, and the U.S. will start to draw down its troops. It's a myth. The Afghan government is isolated. As one Afghan journalist pointed out to me, the fight in Afghanistan is not between democracy and the evil right-wing Taliban. It's between two sets of Muslim fundamentalists, of which the international community supports one faction. The policies of the Karzai government have been going backwards on women, have been going backwards certainly on anything approaching democracy. And it's a warlord, drug kingpin-run government that is increasingly adopting the right-wing policies of the old Taliban.
Bob Perry?
Well, I also would argue that the surge in Iraq has been one of the most dangerous myths that has been perpetrated in this whole process. The idea that Bush's courageous decision in January and February of 2007 to put in 20,000 or so more troops in Iraq turned that situation around is just not true. It's accepted as true in Washington, which is very important. And obviously, Obama is sort of operating within the framework of that myth.
And just to jump in, Obama did appear to resist that until one of the debates with McCain last fall.
Yeah, he tried to give a more sophisticated position, which was the right one, which is there were a number of factors that occurred in 2006 before the surge that had a great deal of effect in finally bringing that violence down. And they weren't all pretty conditions that occurred in 2006. There was, of course, the fact that the Al-Qaeda faction under Zarqawi was so abusive and offensive that it turned off its Sunni allies, who were then also being paid off by the Americans to have what they call the Sunni awakening. That occurs in 2006. Zarqawi himself is killed in June of 2006. There's also this ugly ethnic war that's gone on, which causes a de facto ethnic cleansing, which the U.S. military actually encouraged. The U.S. military helped some of the Sunnis get to Sunni areas and Shiites get to Shiite areas to reduce that violence. So you had these very ugly situations that were effectively probably going to burn themselves out anyway. Into that, Bush throws in the 20,000 additional troops and the new strategy of being more aggressive. The violence in 2007 is just off the charts. And, we see the U.S. casualty list going way up. And then, basically, by summer of 2007, there's a decision, a kind of a realistic decision by the U.S. military not to be so aggressive. And then we start seeing the violence come down. And as the United States then agrees in 2008, kicking and screaming, the Bush administration kicking and screaming to the Status of Forces Agreement, which calls for the withdrawal of American troops to the outskirts of the cities by the middle of 2009, then ultimately later on toward the elimination of the U.S. forces, the real drop in violence is almost more connected to the recognition on the part of the Iraqis that the Americans are leaving, that there's effectively a timetable for the Americans to leave. One could just simply say, maybe if you want to reduce the violence, you make a commitment to get out and you actually start doing it, and at least stop having American patrols working the streets of places like Baghdad and other Iraqi cities. That's where we started seeing the real drop in violence, and not just violence toward American soldiers, but violence among Iraqis. The violence of last month, according, I know these numbers probably are understated, but the Iraqi Health Ministry said that there were 88 people dying from political violence in all of Iraq last month, which is the first time it's been below 100 since Bush unleashed this carnage in March of 2003. So I think what you see is actually a way of reading the data very differently. But in Washington, it became an accepted wisdom that the surge worked. Mm-hmm. And when Obama sort of was pushed into accepting that, he first tried to resist it. He was badgered by Katie Couric and George Stephanopoulos in some of their interviews. Mm-hmm. Finally, in an interview with Fox News with O'Reilly, he says, well, the surge worked beyond our wildest dreams. He was essentially acquiescing to a myth.
Mm-hmm.
But now that myth has become reality, and not just from on the right, it's across the board. The idea that Bush's courageous surge, which Gates was involved with, which Petraeus helped sell, that all these people push this surge myth, is now accepted wisdom. So when you come to Afghanistan, you might have said, hey, maybe in Afghanistan, the best idea is to sort of commit to withdraw, to pull American troops back and see if that's a way to sort of reduce the nationalism or the at least anti-foreignism that you see in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. maybe that will take the winds out of these insurgencies. Instead, because the myth of the surge, the idea is put more troops in.
Yeah. Let's listen to another clip from the president, and we'll get your reaction.
Since then, we've made progress on some important objectives. High-ranking al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders have been killed, and we've stepped up the pressure on al-Qaeda worldwide. In Pakistan, that nation's army has gone on its largest offensive in years. In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election. And although it was marred by fraud, that election produced a government that is consistent with Afghanistan's laws and constitution.
Now, what dissembling is involved there?
Weasel wording.
I mean, that is just, it's over the top. And I think there are a lot of progressives who listen to Obama and don't listen critically to a comment like that. But, you know, Karzai tried to steal the election. I don't know why Abdullah pulled out of the runoff precisely. But to claim that there is a legitimate government in Kabul right now is just laughable, is it not, Reese?
It is indeed. And I love the weasel wording he used, that the government, and he didn't say it's a democratic government. He didn't say it was democratically elected. He said it was consistent with the Constitution. Well, the Obama administration seems to be doing that a lot lately because they're recognizing the new coup government in Honduras, et cetera. So that if, as long as you're pro-U.S., then you're an emerging democracy, even if you hold fraudulent elections. That seems to be the rule of thumb.
Well, and that word, that phrase, consistent with, reminds me of the way Bush tried to claim that while we weren't honoring the Geneva Conventions with the people we detained without charge on an unlimited basis at Guantanamo and elsewhere, that they were being treated consistent with the Geneva Conventions. Bob Perry, your reaction?
Well, there's no question that words have stopped meaning very much at all in this context, and that is, that's something that, you know, we've tried to deal with in our, you know, the work we've done together, Peter, at ConsortiumNews.com, which is we always try to hold people to some sense of reality. But this is clearly a case where reality has stopped having much meaning, especially inside Washington, to some extent across the United States, where people have heard so many of these very facetious sorts of arguments and claims of facts that aren't facts, that it's very difficult to even think of the United States as a meaningful democracy in that sense. We end up living in these fantasy worlds that seem like that they are easier to live with, at least in terms of the political consequences. As long as you send off these young men and women to fight and die and kill, that's a lot easier, really, politically, than to deal with the kinds of abuse you would get politically if you told the truth and said, listen, this is not a government the United States can support. It did win through fraud. We've had a lot of gnashing of teeth and threats relating to Iran, which had an election where the evidence is a lot weaker regarding fraud. The evidence in Afghanistan is overwhelming that this was fraud. It was investigated as such and clearly determined to be such. And Obama is accepting that recognition with the way he described it. So I think we've got a case where words are again being twisted to achieve a political, geopolitical end, and to deceive the American people, which we've seen too much of in the last, certainly the last 20, 30 years.
And despite all this, the puppet government in Kabul is piping up and saying that the surge, the additional troops, is the wrong strategy. So we don't even seem to be able to control the guy with the cape over there and the neat little hats that he wears to stay on message, Reese.
Well, that is a problem when you're running a war of occupation, isn't it? In the old days in Vietnam, we just bumped off the prime minister when we didn't like what he did. The U.S. clearly backed other people than Karzai. During the elections, but that guy came in with less than 3% of the vote. So the U.S. is stuck between a rock and a hard place, which is that it's supposedly doing this in order to get the Afghan government in line so that they take on more responsibilities. They're less corrupt and less drug dealing and so on, and the guys in Kabul are having nothing of it. It's very interesting. When I was in Afghanistan, you got a different perspective because from Karzai's point of view, he he knows that the U.S. is not going to be staying there forever. He doesn't want to be the Najibullah of Afghanistan. That was the guy that was left in power after the Soviets withdrew.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed in power for a few years, and then he was killed, most unceremoniously. So Karzai doesn't want to be that. So he's trying to stake out some independent positions so that he doesn't look to the people of Afghanistan as a like a puppet, while, in fact, his entire government, from the funding to the military to the police, is entirely dependent upon the United States.
Yeah.
So that's the reality. He's trying to convince Afghans that he's independent.
Well, and just as we passed around American dollars in Iraq to buy off the Sunnis through the so-called Awakening Councils, we are now trying to do this, and Karzai, with our money, is trying to hire so-called Taliban fighters into the military. That's fraught with problems because their loyalties will dissipate after the final paycheck is delivered. And we've seen that as a long-term pattern in Afghanistan. So the idea that we can even temporarily buy the loyalty or even just buy passivity from the people who live there is phony. Plus, they live with the threat that when we leave in 18 months or 18 years, that the Taliban and other insurgent forces will settle scores. And anybody who collaborated with the United States occupiers will be taken out or dealt with. Bob?
You know, one of the great tragedies of all this goes back to 1989, and I was at Newsweek at the time, and that was when the Soviets left Afghanistan. And President Gorbachev offered a deal to President George H.W. Bush, which was effectively, let's just see if we can work out some kind of coalition government, you know, take the Najibullah government, the communist government, and some of the Mujahideen, and see if there's a way to work something out to end the civil war and bring peace as best we can to Afghanistan. I remember talking to some CIA people about this, because this was at the beginning of the triumphalism, the end of Cold War triumphalism. And I was talking to them. I said, "Listen, why do we care? Well, the whole purpose of your covert operation in Afghanistan was to drive the Soviets out. It wasn't. There was no particular concern about Afghanistan per se. So why can't you just do something like Gorbachev is talking about?" And the response I got was from one of the agency guys. Said, "Listen, we want to see Najibullah strung up to a light pole." This was in '89. And the feeling was that that would happen very quickly. The Soviets would leave, Najibullah would collapse, and the Mujahideen would take over, and the United States could basically run the place. The trouble was it didn't happen that way. Once Bush spurned Gorbachev, the United States, by the way, there's another myth about the Charlie Wilson war myth, that the United States just washed its hands of Afghanistan at that point. It didn't. It continued to support the Mujahideen. It refused to go along with the coalition. It wanted Najibullah strung up. What happens is the Mujahideen wage an offensive. Najibullah's forces prove stronger than the CIA had expected. They prevent a takeover by the Mujahideen. They survive even longer than the Soviet Union does. Soviet Union collapses in 91. Finally, Yeltsin pulls the plug on them in terms of support and aid. And Najibullah's government collapses in 92. And even then, Massoud comes in, one of the more moderate Mujahideen. And he has a government with some other alliances, and it keeps out some of the more extremist Islamists for a while, but they continue fighting. And finally, the Pakistanis then train this group called the Taliban. These are essentially refugees that have fled to Pakistan. These hardline Islamists, they come in and they take over in the mid-90s. They do, because Najibullah remains in Kabul even years later. They do drag him out of an office, they castrate him, and they string him up, just like was envisioned by the CIA back in 89, except, you know, 7 years later.
Mm-hmm.
By then, virtually the entire intelligentsia of Afghanistan, the more moderates, have been essentially wiped out or driven out of the country. So a lot of what we end up having to deal with, not only was it that the United States was supporting Osama bin Laden and his thugs back in the 80s because they were anti-Soviet. But the decisions made in that first Bush administration came back in a horrible way to damage the security of that region and ultimately the United States when 9/11 happens. So what we don't know is this history. This is important history to remember, that there was this idea the United States could sort of control things, that we weren't going to play ball with anybody, and what happened? So now we're in a situation where, again, there's this idea that if a foreign power pulls out, the government in place will collapse, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. There's actually a good part of this, in that it's very difficult to take over Kabul. Just because the Taliban may have had some success in recent years in some of the rural areas doesn't mean necessarily the government falls immediately any more than Najibullah's government fell immediately. There are a lot of options here, and I'm not sure the United States or the Obama administration in deciding to escalate U.S. involvement is doing what really makes sense in the long term.
Here is the centerpiece of the president's speech.
This review is now complete. And as commander-in-chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home. These are the resources that we need to seize the initiative while building the Afghan capacity that can allow for a responsible transition of our forces out of Afghanistan.
Well, and this is with an eye on trying to avoid being a one-term president. That's the way I interpret it. Reese?
I think that's exactly what it is. And as I said earlier, it's to convince the American public that we only have to hold on for another 18 months. The war is unwinnable militarily. There has to be a political settlement, whether it's tomorrow or after 18 months or another 10 years. The same forces are going to have to sit down and negotiate. Afghans negotiate among themselves to have a government, and the only question is how many Americans and how many Afghan civilians are going to die before that process finally takes place.
Mm-hmm. Bob.
I'm going to have to run pretty quick.
Yeah, I understand, Reese, so why don't we let you go now? I really appreciate your time and your contribution here. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
That's Reese Ehrlich, and again, his books include The Iran Agenda and Target Iraq. Bob Perry continues with us here. And, Bob, what's your comment there on, as I say, the centerpiece of the president's proposal?
Well, I think Reese had the right point, which is that you really do have to look at this as a political resolution. And going back again to that 89 point, where it may well be possible, if one's willing to make some concessions and maybe accept a solution that's not entirely desirable, to have a coalition approach that would resolve or at least tamp down the violence in Afghanistan. It doesn't have to be an either or. It doesn't have to be that either a pro-U.S. government sits in Kabul or an al-Qaeda backed government sits in Kabul. It can be something where concessions are made. Now, because of the mistakes made over the years, the determination to fight the war in during the 80s, And for all their faults, the communist government that the Soviets were backing had some good sides to them too. They did have a governmental bureaucracy that functioned. They respected the rights of women. There were tremendous efforts to bring women into the social and political life of Afghanistan. Women were not forced into burqas under the communists. So, but the United States decided, for Cold War reasons that, you know, in my view, were unjustified and rather excessive at that point in the 80s, to make this major effort to defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan, which led to a tremendous amount of violence and death. Not to say that the communist government was good or the Soviets were good in any way, but to say that there are ways to deal with that differently that were passed over in exchange for this kind of confrontation, this violent confrontation. And that has just continued. In a sense, Afghanistan has been set on a course that because the various powerful governments that have tried to be involved have been unwilling to make concessions, unwilling to make difficult deals, the killing has just gone on, and the situation has gotten appreciably worse. Afghanistan really does not have, at this point, the kind of well-educated middle class of moderates that you would hope a country would have that could function and work with the various factions.
Yeah, I mean, this is a relay where there is nobody to hand off to, and he is trying to present this illusion that with just a little more time and, billions more dollars and what I consider a measly 30,000 troops. The Pentagon's own insurgency protocols call for numbers that are unattainable. 600,000 American troops would be needed to really stabilize and pacify that country. And so this is a fool's errand from almost every angle.
And there might be a way to try in drawing back the U.S. and NATO occupation of this country. That could have a better effect. I would argue that the real violence drop-off in Iraq came when the United States agreed to pull back, when U.S. troops got off the streets of Baghdad. But again, the ability to frame a debate, which is what especially the right and the neoconservatives have been so effective in doing, in building up their media institutions and their think tanks and their and the magazines and Fox News and all the rest of it, their ability to frame the debate and get the mainstream press to sort of tag along and accept these sort of false realities, or at least disputed realities, like the successful surge. Their ability to do that has had tremendous consequences. And until that is shaken, until there's a way to say, hold it, there's a different way to read this evidence, there's a more reasonable way to read the evidence, or the facts really go in a very, very different direction than what these guys are claiming. Until that can be done consistently, as long as people have to finesse the dynamic, the framework that the right essentially has dictated to this country for a long time now, it's very difficult even for well-meaning politicians to do the right thing, because to do so has an extremely high political cost. So they do what Obama did last night, which is essentially say, well, you know, it's easier for me to send 30,000 more men and women off to fight and die than it is to get savaged on the op-ed pages of the Washington Post, or be called a weakling on Fox News, or to have some the Republicans and some neoconservative Democrats thump me for being a ditherer.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, we end up with almost, as I wrote in that piece. I mean, not that Obama doesn't deserve responsibility or blame for what he's done. It's that he was, in a sense, boxed in. He caged himself, if you will, and especially when he made certain concessions, like for the gesture of bipartisanship, he keeps on Robert Gates.
Yeah,
Robert Gates was the promoter of the surge.
Yeah.
It was completely misunderstood when Rumsfeld left in November of 2006. Rumsfeld was pushing for American withdrawal. I know this is hard for some liberals to accept.
Yeah,
but that's what the documentary evidence is. He sent a memo to Bush on November 6, 2006, saying, we have got to, you know, I prefer here my above-the-line proposals than what I prefer, and it called for a major reduction in American forces, essentially getting Americans out by mid-2007. And Bush immediately fires him,
yeah,
and brings in Gates. The conventional wisdom was Gates was going to be the reasonable guy to wind down the Iraq war. What Gates does is provide cover for the surge and an escalation. To deal with a violence problem that was probably burning itself out already, but then because of the coincidental timing of after a while the surge, the violence begins to dip. The coincidence becomes the reality, rather than any kind of causal relationship necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
We always want to say the American troops are great and good, and they're always positive force. The argument becomes almost politically something that can't be opposed within certainly the Washington reality and within the political system of our country. So everyone buys into the surge, and now we're seeing it replayed based on these, I think, what essentially are false factual arguments and this idea of what the political framing permits in Washington, not on the reality of Afghanistan.
Yeah. And, Bob, you also include the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, in the group that caged Obama in as a real hawk in this picture. Explain a little bit, please.
Well, she and Gates apparently were the key pushers of the 30,000 figure. Obviously, there was McChrystal, who was, again, McKiernan, who was the general in charge when Obama's administration comes in, was considered not aggressive enough, not PR-ish enough, not press-savvy enough. They wanted a Petraeus-like figure in Afghanistan. So this is a decision made more in the Pentagon, but Obama goes along with it. And they remove McKiernan and put in McChrystal. McChrystal's a hardliner. He was the guy that was heading up the Special Operations Command, which was involved in some very dirty Phoenix-like programs in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and to some degree elsewhere.
Yeah,
where civilians were being killed. There was an effort to go after the infrastructure. All these kinds of things that we would call death squads, if in a different setting, they were being carried out under McChrystal. McChrystal's a hardliner. So you have Gates, who has established himself now as a great Washington wise man. You have Hillary Clinton, who has always been a hawk on the Middle East. She's the one who threatened to obliterate Iran during the presidential campaign if it went after Israel.
I remember.
So you have these hawkish hardliners, this so-called team of rivals that Obama bought into during the transition, which is based on a Doris Kearns Goodwin book about Lincoln, how he assembled his cabinet. It's sort of a silly thing to sort of apply it today in our current circumstance. But it was sort of catchy and had a certain narrative tone to it. So Obama starts doing this, and he essentially puts in people who are not in line with what he at least was people thought he wanted to do, which was to seek a more peaceful approach to sort of pull America out of these conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. So he puts in these people who are going to basically corner him, and then McChrystal does his report, demanding 40,000 troops. It's immediately leaked.
Mm-hmm.
Obama's then called a ditherer for not acting immediately and giving McChrystal what he wants. So Obama's in a box.
If
he wants to fight his way out of it, he could. He's president of the United States, but it would be an extraordinary political cost in terms of where his standing in Washington. And beyond things that relate just to foreign policy, it also might well have sunk his health care reform bill, because people like Joe Lieberman,
mm-hmm.
who are sort of holding themselves out on the health reform, were determined to get these escalations in Afghanistan. So Obama sort of has a lot of balls juggling in the air, but he made it more difficult for himself by putting in his rivals or even enemies into these key positions.
And well, in a moment, I want to talk about the political equations and whether the Democrats on the Hill will support this initiative. But first, I want to play this clip from the president describing his so-called new strategy in Afghanistan.
Our overarching goal remains the same: to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to prevent its capacity to threaten America and our allies in the future. To meet that goal, we will pursue the following objectives within Afghanistan. We must deny al-Qaeda a safe haven. We must reverse the Taliban's momentum and deny it the ability to overthrow the government. And we must strengthen the capacity of Afghanistan's security forces and government so that they can take lead responsibility for Afghanistan's future.
And these three just strike me as ridiculous, Bob. Because the idea of the safe haven for al-Qaeda, he paid lip service to Pakistan's lip service to actually, tracking down and capturing or killing the remaining leaders of al-Qaeda who are likely in Pakistan. The idea of reversing Taliban momentum in Afghanistan is first an oversimplification because the Taliban is not the only insurgent force there. And also the nature of trying to sway the loyalties of indigenous people who will fear retaliation from Taliban and other forces when we leave. And then finally, the canard that we can strengthen the Karzai government and those military forces. And that's even more laughable when you put an 18-month time frame on it.
Well, right. It doesn't really add up, does it? The hard thing in these situations is to sit down with the various sides and deal with people you don't like and try to work out some kind of coalition. It's been a problem that the United States has faced. Certainly, you can go back to Vietnam when there was early on a possibility of dealing with Ho Chi Minh and having some kind of coalition government covering elections to govern Vietnam. And the decision by the United States was to go the other way, which was to demand that, at least in the South, that the U.S. have its government that it wanted. And that led to tremendous horrors and damage to the United States and to the world. And prices were still paying for much of that because of the divisions that were created in the United States around Vietnam are still reverberating these many years later. We had a similar situation when you get to a decision about what to do with Afghanistan in the 80s. And even in the 70s, when Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski, as national security advisor, began this sort of taunting the Soviets by supporting limited covert actions in Afghanistan. Those were then expanded by the Reagan administration with this theory that this exaggeration of the Soviet power, the ideological demand then was to see the Soviets as 10 feet tall. They were about to conquer the world, and that would justify massive expansions of American military budgets and the support of these essentially terrorist operations like the Contras in Nicaragua, and supporting these Islamists in Afghanistan to sort of fight the Soviets. That exaggeration of the Soviet power and the need to go on the offensive. Repeatedly, the United States has refused to say there are ways we can work these situations out with less violence, more peacefully, that are beneficial to the countries we're talking about, and ultimately beneficial to the United States' national security interests and the safety of the world. Each one of these mistakes, basing it often on false theories or facts that weren't really facts, like the exaggeration of the Soviet power in the 80s when the Soviet Union was really collapsing, that this constant use of this ratcheting up and the baiting of domestic opponents, calling them weak or calling them defeatists or apologists. So whenever anyone tries to say, hold it, can we go a different way, they are essentially excluded, marginalized from our political process. They're shoved to the sidelines at best, if not completely discredited and destroyed, as we've seen in so many cases when people have criticized this idea of going to war constantly. So you have, that's the political reality in the United States. And until that changes, until people can be more responsible and sort of say what's real, that sometimes American military force is counterproductive, that sometimes American soldiers do things that are horribly wrong in a place and cause a great deal of resentment, like calling in airstrikes on weddings just to get, maybe to get one militant, but to kill dozens of people that are not even involved in the fight. These kinds of actions, which we don't want to talk about because it makes we have to then criticize the American troops. We don't like to criticize the American troops, as to do so gets you attacked as you're anti-troop, you're anti-American. So until we can get past that silliness and deal with the real world in a real responsible way, it's very hard to see how we're going to solve these problems. What Obama did on Tuesday night was to essentially try to finesse the Washington sense of what's real, which is not real, with the situation on the ground in Afghanistan. And that is a square that cannot be made into a circle. That is something that is that until you start dealing with the real world in Afghanistan and the possibility, as much as people like Joe Lieberman would attack you and Dick Cheney would attack you, that you really do have to sit down with people you don't like and make concessions and work out a deal. And it keeps getting worse. If we had done this back in 1980, it would have been one thing, or 89, it would have been something else. It's going to be much worse making these deals with the Taliban in a realistic sense now. But that's the way this game has been played out. The options for the United States do not get better. They get worse.
And, Bob, the only thing I'd add to your excellent commentary there is that it was Bob Gates who was front and center in hyping the Soviet threat in the 1980s. So he's had a lot of practice at politicization of military issues for personal advancement and to echo the agenda of the administration in power.
Right. Gates is probably the most... in terms of falsifying the intelligence and essentially creating many of the problems we're facing today, if you have to go back and see who are the top 10 people most responsible, Bob Gates would certainly be on that list. He played games to advance his career in the 80s. He exaggerated the Soviet threat. He was the action officer in destroying the objectivity and professionalism of the CIA's analytical division. Bill Casey, Reagan's CIA director, put him in charge of that assignment. He went through and then purged, especially the Soviet section of the so-called Kremlinologists, at CIA because they were not. They were saying the Soviet Union is showing weakness and is moving toward collapse. That was the wrong answer. You're supposed to say they were 10 feet tall and moving on to world domination to justify the military buildups. So you had all these. So Bob Gates was the guy who was behind the scenes creating much of the problem that we see today, and that sort of played out terribly in Iraq. But because of the way Washington works, he has been elevated into kind of a wise man status. He certainly has a nice appealing style. He's soft-spoken. But that's not the real Bob Gates. People should look at the history of these people. People like a Colin Powell is the same kind of thing. There's a history to these people that is not what their image is. And by since Washington doesn't deal with reality, Washington deals with imagery and perception, it's a very dangerous situation that's been allowed to develop. And Bob Gates is a perfect example of what you're talking about.
Now I want to turn to whether the president can muster support on Capitol Hill for the additional expenditures and commitment of troops. And as you have alluded to in our conversation so far, Bob, the impact it'll have on other legislation like the effort at health care insurance reform. Here's a sop that he threw in for the base. The people who won that primary for him in Iowa against Hillary Clinton, the anti-war people who wanted to hear a very different speech from the president on Tuesday night.
I did not think that the security of the United States and the safety of the American people were at stake in Afghanistan. I would gladly order every single one of our troops home tomorrow.
Yeah. So I have not really been able at this point, Bob, to look nationally at the reaction to the president's speech, but the San Francisco Chronicle compiled comments from Speaker Pelosi and from about six members of the Democratic Bay Area congressional delegation. And they all had very carefully calibrated statements where they offered some faint support for the president, but each one of them closed their remarks by saying they did not support the commitment of the 30,000 additional troops. So what is your reading? I realize it's just overnight and people are still weighing in, but what is your sense of whether the president can really get this through on Capitol Hill? And if not, this could be a setback for his foreign policy, a setback for domestic policy, and in my view, he is at risk of being a one-term president because of these fumbles.
Well, I think that last part, I think, is certainly true. He has the way he's sort of squandered, or at least showed a very great degree of timidity in terms of how he approached these issues going back to the transition a year ago. And I haven't really had a chance to do much temperature taking on Capitol Hill today, but I would guess he will almost certainly get what he wants here, because the Democrats, despite complaining and expressing some dissatisfaction, are likely to grudgingly support him, at least enough of them. And the Republicans, while they may certainly want to cripple him, which is certainly what they've been trying to do for the last 10 months, they probably would support him on something like this because he's given them pretty much what they wanted. He's given them an escalation in Afghanistan. And the neoconservatives have spoken up generally in support of that. This morning, the Washington Post was full of sort of mixed praise, but mostly praise for Obama's decision. Bill, if you read the Washington Post editorial section, it's almost all neocon. And Bill Kristol was given us some space to say how he was annoyed about this idea of maybe pulling troops out by 2011, but thought it was a great idea to send more in.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's going to be the dominant view. So my guess is, and you look at how the Democrats behave when Bush tried to push through various provisions of, in terms of escalating and doing and sending through supplementals to pay for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The Democrats usually complain and then cave in. So I would guess you would see a similar pattern where there'll be some complaining and then caving in. So I think he'll probably get what he wants here, but whether what he wants will have the kind of effect he is hoping for is a very different question.
And do you know, practically speaking, can he is there enough funding that can be moved around to commit these troops. And, you know, he's talking about some of them arriving in the next 30 to 60 days. That would be faster than Congress could act to reduce funding or, you know, fail to pass another supplemental. What do you think, just in broad terms, is it possible for him to enact this before Congress could take action to block funding?
Oh, yes. I think he's obviously operating under, as he said last night, under the resolution in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So he has what he would claim. There were some constitutional scholars who might disagree, but he would claim, and I'm sure Congress would go along with, the notion that he's able to do what he's talking about. The only real power Congress would have in the traditional view here that we're talking about is to cut off the funding. So they'd have to then act that way. Now, they also could refuse to approve a supplemental, which could have effects down the road. But at least in the short term, the money is available under the budget. It just might mean that if they didn't do the supplemental, money would run out later on in the year.
Yeah. Bob, as we wrap up here, what would you like to add?
Well, I think it's I guess I'm not surprised by the way this has gone, since we've been writing a consortium news really since the transition, that by stacking his administration the way he did, with the kinds of personalities that he chose, and with their records, that he was playing a very dangerous game. Obama was playing a dangerous game in terms of trying to really take the country in a really different direction. That's not just his fault. I would also blame the American left, as we've talked about before, that the American left does not have the kind of infrastructure, media, think tanks, et cetera, that the right has built and that the center has. So without that, in the real world, that's like artillery on the battlefield. And so politicians will tend to gravitate to what they consider the safer grounds, even if maybe they're more dangerous in the long term. And it's not really enough for the American left to sort of walk back, climb back into the stands and start shouting insults and threats. It really does. If there's going to be a change, it's going to have to be built. It's going to have to be investing money and time and talent and various kinds of resources in creating that kind of informational and ideological infrastructure that can argue these points and make them and challenge the false assumptions and the mythology. Until that happens, I think you're going to see politicians like Obama, who may be one of the better people who's been in the White House for a while, which isn't really saying, I guess, too much,
right?
But is someone who might actually want to do some decent things, but feels constantly hemmed in and under attack when he tries to do them, and is always trying to fight for that one or two extra votes he needs for some even modest reform. Until that whole structure changes, until the American political system undergoes a certain kind of transformation that allows reality to play more of a role and that serious thought can be injected more consistently, I think we're in for a very rough ride.
Bob Perry, thank you for joining me today. Your analysis, context, and history, superb as usual, and I appreciate that. I want to direct people to get more information and read some of your pieces and the other journalists that you publish at consortiumnews.com. And I will also mention that you have an ambitious fundraising drive underway to help that very infrastructure that you just referred to. The work that you do is solid, credible, and important. And I hope that if people have the means, that they will go to your website and help support you in your current fund drive.
Thank you, Peter.
Good to talk with you. And we also thank Reese Ehrlich, who had to go off to another interview. He joined us for the first portion of this part of the Peter B. Collins Show. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. What's the human cost of the escalation?
Yeah. What? Absolutely.
Nothing.
Uh-huh.
Joining me now is Michael Blecker. He's at San Francisco's Swords to Plowshares, and they support veterans of all eras. Michael Blecker, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks, Peter.
I wanted to get your take on what you project as the human cost to American service members of President Obama's decision to commit 30,000 more troops, which brings us to about 100,000 in Afghanistan. Even though he says they'll start coming home in 18 months, that's a conditional thing with a lot of asterisks. So tell us your thoughts based on what we've seen in the last 8 years of what we project to be the human toll of this escalation.
Well, first of all, our mission is that we recognize that war causes wounds and suffering that last beyond the battlefield, and a lot of our work is really informed by the experience of the Vietnam War, because we started in 1974 when the war was still going on, the Vietnam War was still going on, so we know a little bit about the cost of war and also the cost of neglecting the needs of those who fight those wars in terms of benefits, in terms of eventual health. The toll it takes in health care, the homelessness, et cetera. But a recent study that's been widely cited, a study that, by the way, was privately funded, not funded by the government or Congress. It was a RAND corporate study, and it was funded by the Iraq Vet Afghanistan Project. And that revealed that 15% of those who are exposed to combat suffer from the effects of depression, anxiety, PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, another 15% suffer from the real signature wound of this war, which is traumatic brain injury, because so many soldiers, when you're sent to a combat zone, I also must state, most soldiers go repeatedly to a combat zone. They have multiple tours,
right,
which is very unique to this particular war. But so many, 80% who go to a combat zone experience rocket, mortar fire, incoming artillery, roadside bombing. And over 33% handle or uncover human remains. 50% see dead or seriously injured Americans. 70% know someone seriously injured or killed. 60% saw dead bodies or human remains. 56% had a member of the unit become a casualty. So that's exposing those folks to trauma, unusual trauma. It's certainly not unusual for a war, but nevertheless, it's combat trauma. And it's repeated combat trauma because they have multiple tours. And if you think of 15% as a conservative number, then you're talking about the fact if you have about 2 million who have served in a combat zone, you're talking about 300,000.
Mm-hmm.
And another 300,000 for traumatic brain injury.
Yeah.
So those are significant numbers.
And to date, since we went into Afghanistan and Iraq, do you believe that, to what extent have we properly addressed the needs of returning veterans?
Well, just for everyone, we have, the VA has done as best as it could. It's got additional funding, but the VA, like all healthcare systems, ration care. There's all the systems are fairly tapped out from that standpoint. I mean, we know that a number of veterans have gotten health care, but have they gotten adequate mental health care and adequate physical health care? We know they haven't got compensated for their injuries, that there's many, many claims that are pending. So veterans, besides the delays in treatment and compensation, have experienced those kind of hardships.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get away from the from a care system that has to ration its care system because it's, you know, your significant numbers of need and patients.
And one of the things that comes to mind as well, Michael, is the long-term nature of this commitment to our troops and our failures over the past. I recall that some of the World War One veterans have really just started to pass or final the
World
final
War II.
Group has
World
passed
War II
away.
Veterans. Yeah, that's correct.
And World War II vets are still in the mix. And
yeah.
So this becomes a 60 to 70 year
right.
commitment, doesn't
right.
it?
Right. You're absolutely correct.
And do we budget for that? Do we account for that? Is that
no,
in
of course
the...
not. Of course not. In fact, I mean, right now there are commissions being formed to figure out how to trim Social Security and Medicare. Those are considered costs that are stretching our budget. Well, certainly, veterans' benefits are in that category as well.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of costs that go on, and it's one thing when there's a war going on and people's attention are directed to those who fight the war, But once the war is removed from the front pages, you know, it really gets lost in other priorities. That's what we learned from Vietnam, that's for sure.
Well, and I would argue that these wars have been really distinct from the general population.
Yeah.
And that many people don't feel any sense of connection or responsibility for the veterans and the damage that they have endured and will live with for the rest of their lives.
Right, and it's, you know, 1% wear their uniform, right? But it's not just the veterans, it's the families. I mean, we're seeing it, it's especially among female veterans. We're seeing problems with the children of veterans, alarming number. We're seeing problems with debt service. You know, no-brainers that you would think are going to be, there's going to be consequences when people are deployed to war.
Mm-hmm.
And there are.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, we don't pay people enough when they're fighting. And while, you know, Obama gave this speech before cadets at West Point and, you know, praised the troops and honored their service and, you know, gave rhetoric to a commitment to long term, the fact is that the actions don't back that up.
Well, rhetoric is, you know, rhetoric won't solve a lot of key issues. You know, it's, you know, talk is cheap, and the commitment of action and medical care and resources, that's another story.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, with the vets that you service, are you seeing any indications of the impact of the use of depleted uranium in Iraq?
You know, I certainly during the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, there was a rampant problem with depleted uranium, and also just the fact that it wasn't, you know, we weren't informed of the dangers, and the soldiers weren't informed of the dangers till 5 years after they were separated.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say I'm not informed about the current implication of the use of depleted uranium. You know, how the tanks and the artillery shells, et cetera.
Yeah, okay. And I wanted to ask you, because I got a release from Paul Rykoff's group, the Iraq-Afghanistan
right.
Veterans of America.
Right.
And one of the points they make is that currently the veterans' health care bill for this fiscal year is 61 days late.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fact?
Well, there's always been a challenge of getting the health care bill. I think Obama did pass what they call the two-year bill, which will allow the VA to plan a little bit, and they know they have the funding in store for another year after this year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a major breakthrough, because they were getting year-to-year funding. They couldn't really do proper planning.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's, the bills are always late for those kind of matters.
Yeah. And tell me what it's like at your agency. Do you receive government funding, or is all yours coming from private? And,
No. We receive, you know, we do a lot of, you know, we serve about 1,800 veterans a year. We have housing for 200 veterans, and that housing comes from HUD, federal dollars. It comes from the VA, the Grant Per Diem Program, which allows us to do residential treatment. It comes from San Francisco's Health Department. They've been very generous. They allow us to do a drop-in mental health program. So we benefit the Department of Labor. We have employment and training programs. So we've been able to benefit. We've been able to take former bases, closed bases, and converted them to housing on Treasure Island and the Presidio. So we've been able to do a lot. And a lot of it comes from Department of Labor and the federal contracts and grants.
Mm-hmm. And do you need private funds? In other words, would you benefit if our listeners could make a contribution?
You know, especially, Peter, from the standpoint of policy. You know, it's one thing to do direct services. It's another thing to say, here's what's broken in the system, and here's how we can correct it. And to do that requires, you know, an ability to sort of, like, promote, inform, have a good website, get a seat at the policy table,
mm-hmm.
be able to present what your lessons you're learning from the field. So I think SOARS is unique as a policy body, because we're doing the direct care, so we know what's broken in the system, and we report that out to the public. So that's
mm-hmm.
really an important thing, to do policy stuff and to educate and to inform the public, and you don't get funding to do that.
Yeah, well, you can use the word lobby, too, because what you're doing is...
We use the word educate, Peter.
Yeah, but it's lobbying in the good sense of the word. Uh-huh. It's not the K Street Gucci loafer types.
Right.
Now,
whatever footwear they're wearing, right?
Okay. And what is your website, please?
Well, our website is www.stp-sf.org.
Okay.
And we have this material called Combat to Community that I would really recommend folks take a look at. It's really a wonderful look at all these issues, and it's directed at sort of first responders and, you know, employers to get a sense of who the community is. Because, again, as you said, only 1% of those are wearing a uniform.
Yeah, stp-sf.org.
Right.
Now, what is the nature of homelessness that you're seeing among those who have fought recently? We know about the tragic element and the high percentage of Vietnam vets who are on the streets. But as we head into the most difficult season of the year for homeless people, what are you seeing in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan vets who are homeless?
Well, we know that over 3,000 have been enrolled in VA homeless systems of care. Now, that's not the whole bang, so that's just the VA homeless programs. We know that they're showing up, becoming homeless quicker. It used to be that it would take about 10 years to hit bottom, and now it's taking probably half that long.
Mm-hmm.
So we know there are really these very negative trends that we're seeing. Now, you got to keep in mind, these men and women are young. They're living at home. They still haven't burned those bridges, you know, and so they're able to, you know, to get through this period of time. And, you know, hopefully there'll be good employment and training programs, and many will be able to use a new GI Bill. Those are, like, meaningful opportunities. Those are meaningful exits out of homelessness.
But, Michael, what you cited earlier, the 30% roughly of those with PTSD or traumatic brain injury, these cause very serious complications with family life.
Absolutely.
It often leads to drug use, self-medication,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and a desire to be alone because the demons are so great, the pain is so difficult to bear that interacting with a wife, with kids, with parents becomes very, very challenging.
Absolutely. And again, because so few of the population serve, they tend to feel isolated, even in their own communities.
Mm-hmm.
But that's true, yes.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Sure.
I appreciate the work that you do, and I hope that people will support your efforts, both in a policy way and with contributions if they can.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate
Michael
it.
Blecker at Swords to Plowshares in San Francisco. The Peter B. Collins Show is sponsored by our friends at the Organic Wine Company. And now that you're eating organic food, wash it down with great organic wines. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since all the way back in the last century, 1980. Click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer just in time for the holidays. And now lighten things up. After our jury discussion of Afghanistan, we'll go to the movies, get some popcorn, and get a little bummed out as we take a look at the new film called The Road.
This ain't no technological breakdown. Oh no, this is the road to hell.
Gary Chu is our official film reviewer here on the Peter B. Collins Show, and he just got some new Italian designer frame spectacles, so he's looking better and seeing better. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Peter B. Actually, Peter, I haven't gotten the spectacles yet. They come in 5 to 8 business days, I think it is.
Oh, I see.
I still got my old wire ones on my face right now.
Okay.
I can see pretty well.
Well, you tipped me off over a week ago to this new film called The Road, and it's based on Cormac McCarthy's book of the same name, and he, of course, was the guy who wrote No Country for Old Men. And I was telling you before we went on the air here that I tried to see it over the Thanksgiving weekend, but we were trapped in the Black Friday weekend super sales at Best Buy.
Oh, dear.
And didn't get to the theater that night, so I haven't seen it yet. Why don't you tell our listeners what you think about it?
Well, the movie is a very important film. It has a lot to say. The message is really strong, and it's actually the movie is not as good as the novel, but The Road by Cormac McCarthy. In fact, the novel won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for fiction. That's how good it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the film before I saw the movie, and so I was slightly let down because this film It's about a post-apocalyptic time. Supposedly in the United States, we're not sure. There aren't any significant things given as to where it is and exactly when it is and even why what happened and all of that. But it's about this man who has his 8 to 10, 12-year-old son with him, and they're slogging across this desolate area that's been sort of upended by what seems to be possibly a nuclear holocaust or possibly maybe global warming at its when it's really getting serious,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
And they have to avoid all of these people that are still alive who are going around preying on other human beings because there aren't any animals left, plants aren't growing, insects are dead, and so there is cannibalism afoot. So it's a real happy film.
Yeah.
And but it basically it's about values, and it's about the kids wanting to help other people when they see them and they're down and out, and the father being pragmatic and realizing that, well, we have to be careful about who we help because these people may want to kill us and eat us, or they may, you know, they want to do us harm. So he was trying to help the boy and make him help him survive. And then also there's the consideration that everything is so bleak and they have to eat such terrible things to stay alive, and the weather is so nuclear or winterish most of the time, that possibly committing suicide might be the best option. So mm-hmm. all those things are combined into the story that Cormac McCarthy wrote for this novel, which works better as a novel because it has much more of a power on the page, although the movie is not slighting itself from anything in terms of, you know, making it easier for us to understand or to swallow, so to speak. But it just doesn't play quite as well as a film. And my feeling is, looking at some of the very cursory at some things that relate to this film, I'm thinking the film probably won't do very well in terms of box office because people are going to be afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be afraid to go see it, and they don't realize that McCarthy is really saying a whole lot. There's a line in my review which just kind of sneaks by that I want to read to you and your listeners, which came to me as I was writing it, and it really is an important part of the review. Besides suggesting a rationale why peaceniks march, The Road shows a series of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this is why people are admonish other people about big wars. You know, this is what's going to happen if it happens, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think that's a good part of it, the film review. And also, the film has some pretty grisly things in it, too, in terms of some human beings doing terrible things to other human beings. And it gave me a kind of a feeling of what the novel and film Deliverance by James Dickey wrote, which came out a long time ago with Burt Reynolds and
sure.
a bunch of people. A big, real important film, too.
70s, yeah.
Yeah, it was really a creepy film. And this movie has its creepy places, although I hate to say this to give it away, it does end on a note of hope.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say that to your listeners if they want to go see it, because it is quite uplifting, but I'll tell you, it's a long slog to get there. But
so we've got Viggo Mortensen, that I remember him from The Ring and other films.
Right.
Charlize Theron, and is she sexy at all in this post-apocalyptic environment?
There are some flashbacks to the time when the family was happy prior to whatever happened.
Mm-hmm.
And there you can see her in with nice Technicolor and all of this, and she's got a pretty dress on, and you know she's a lovely woman, and you can see that she and Viggo are quite cozy with one another as husband and wife, and then they have this boy, this child, just about the time of the whatever it is happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kid doesn't know anything else, and he's grown up in all this. And then the wife, actually, I don't want to get into what the wife happens, what goes on with her, because I don't want to give that much away of the film.
All right, that's fine.
But
And what about Robert Duvall? Is he kind of
a
heavy?
He has a very small part. It looks like it's something they want to let him walk off with a quick Best Supporting Actor role with or something. He just shows up with this grimy old man walking down this cold, wet road, and they spend the night together with Vigo and the son and Duvall, and they sit around the campfire and talk about all this heavy value stuff, and it gives Duvall this chance to kind of, you know, go into some soliloquy in that that Texas or Southern accent of his to kind of, you know, give it that Cormac McCarthy touch, because McCarthy likes stories about men or lonesome men in doing things, and also primarily people from the southern part of the United States, because as No Country for Old Men was about, you know, Texans along the Rio Grande fighting drug traffickers. But it's an excellent film, but taking it from the novel to the screen is not as effective as No Country for Old Men was, that McCarthy wrote, that the Coen brothers did. That was really a classic film, and it certainly deserved to win the Oscar, I think. And only with a reading of No Country for Old Men was I able to understand exactly what these Coen brothers were doing with that film. This film doesn't quite live up to that. But I do hope it plays well with the Oscars because of the very weight and importance of the message it has for people to really consider these things there may be some such consequences if people keep screwing around like they've been screwing around with stuff all these several past decades.
Yeah.
If you probably know more about that than I do.
Now, Gary, I want people to be able to access your review online. That's at TulsaTVMemories.com, TulsaTVMemories.com. And let me just lift a line and ask you about this. You say, my experience with the craft of McCarthy has taught me to not necessarily expect much detail or resolution to some threads in his stories. Now, did that leave you frustrated, and particularly if you could compartmentalize what you knew from the book before you saw the film, would you have been frustrated as a moviegoer who hadn't read the book because these threads really are left dangling?
That is a Peter B. Collins question, a very good one. This movie gave you a little more information about what's going on with the threads as compared to the novel than the No Country for Old Men did. The Coen brothers kept it almost obscure on purpose, or it's so subtle that on a second or third reading of that film, you might understand what it was that you missed the first time. But this movie is a little more upfront about everything. It just doesn't dwell on specifics. There are a lot of great novels that I've read way back a long time ago when I was younger that are classic books that really don't dwell on specifics. They're about profundity and human emotion and values and philosophy, or, you know, things like that. That's what they're more about. The specifics are not so important. But yeah, this movie is more specific than it doesn't frustrate you. At least it didn't me, because I knew that I wasn't going to get the full skinny on what exactly happened, or exactly where they were, or what exactly the year was, or all that kind of stuff.
Now, Gary, you mentioned that there are at least references to cannibalism. Do they take you into the kitchen and give you some tips on how to prepare a good human?
No, they don't. They just imply that I think there are some little things in the film that show where maybe some skulls are or something like that, and they have some people who are actually locked in a basement, and they are being held prisoner, sort of like a bunch of chickens in a chicken coop to be used as sustenance. I mean, it's really pretty grim. Although they're very fleeting glances, just enough to let you know what it is, and they don't stay on them. But it's pretty. I must tell you, as to try to get out of this dreary talk, if I've got some time here, when I did a radio review of this with a scripted radio review of this last week, the guy who was on the air playing my review closed out the segment with John Lennon singing, "Why Don't We Do It in the Road?" he had to get out of it some way to make it funny. You know, I guess he had to change this from a post-apocalyptic situation to sex for teenagers or something.
And any joking references to the Donner Party? I guess I'm just not dark enough for this today. Sorry.
I used to use that as a handle online where it's like, just northeast of the Donner Party Family Grill. I used that line.
You did.
That's sick.
It is, yeah.
That's really sick. But we've got to be able to laugh. We've got to laugh.
Well, now, let me ask you one more thing. If you had a choice of seeing 2012, which is a kind of apocalyptic film, which does have a bit of a hopeful ending, or The Road, which would you recommend to our listeners?
I cannot be honest about that because I didn't see 2012.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't see it. I don't see all of the movies that come out, Peter. We kind of select them since I sort of do them on my own.
Well, in that case, I saw 2012, and unless you really like the same special effects repeated for 2.5 hours with very little character development and a very obvious storyline, you can pass on it.
I think I will. I think the lead character in it is a very fine actor, and I've seen the trailer play over and over and over and over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I could tell by looking at the trailer that I didn't need to see it, but I did need to see The Road because it dealt with what we ourselves individually can sort of do to make something like this not happen.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Whereas the 2012 thing, it's out of our hands, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. And as I said, it's two special effects. One is where the ground splits open, and that was perfected in The Day After Tomorrow. And the other is the routine where the Earth is imploding underneath various vehicles. A limo at one point that Keanu Reeves is driving, and then, you know, just about everything else, including airplanes later on. And frankly, I just tired of it. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that might have been edited down to, somewhere just over an hour, and it would have been a little more tolerable. But I just thought they figured they had invested big bucks in those special effects, and they were going to milk them for the max.
And I imagine they sold a lot of tickets with it this past week, too. That would be my guess. I don't know.
Well, it's been doing fairly well. I didn't check the Thanksgiving box office numbers myself. Well, Gary Chu, thank you very much, and I'll look forward to seeing a picture of you in your snappy new glasses.
Okay, well, I'll email you something.
Real good. Gary Chu.
I hope your teeth are clean, too.
Oh, they're perfect today.
Well, that's right.
We didn't mention I went to the dentist, but now they know. Gary, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Okay, bye.
Happy trails.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails.